Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and this is Carl from Deviant Legion and Incredibly Strange Television, and nice to have you with us today. However, I must say, of course, we have my guest host, well, my co-host, Rachel, with me. Say hello, Rachel.
Well, hello, Rachel, and I just want you to know the reason I sound so forlorn is we're waiting for my mother from another bloodline to show up, and she's not here.
And here she comes. She was having connectivity problems, so hopefully this works.
Hey,
Vicky,
hopefully.
Can you hear us now?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes. We can.
Yes.
Yay!
What
the fuck
is happening?
I don't know.
Did you get ratchet
connected
at the beginning of the show?
No, I never got hooked up. I got Blog Talk put me on and said, you know, wait just a minute. And then they said, after like 2 minutes, thank you for listening to the show. Click.
Yep. It raptured you at the beginning of the show. It does that to me all the time. So I'm guessing since you were later than me, you took my place in the rapture today.
Okay.
I appreciate your sacrifice.
You're very welcome, because, you know, I've never been raptured before. Can't say I like it. But then again, being a very unreligious person, I guess that's what I deserve.
I was about to say, can't say you're ever going to have a chance to do it again, are you?
Well, maybe Blog Talk.
Yeah, I was about to say, if Blog Talk keeps up with you, so it's like Blog Talk, the atheist Jesus figure there. The only way you're ever going to get raptured is if you talk to Blog Talk.
Maybe so. Maybe. I just want the doctor to come down and rescue me from all this shit and take me off, and I'll be a companion. Even if it's just 1 year, I'll just be a companion. Please, 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 please.
Speaking of, I saw the best thing in an adult cartoon recently where he was having to slap some shit into some people, basically, and he's a camp counselor, and he's going to his other camp counselor friend, and he goes, look, a British doctor is not going to fly down here and rescue you, so get your shit together. Yes.
Oh, that's pretty funny.
I loved that, and I loved that my 13-year-old who showed me this cartoon, of mostly adult cartoon, also got the reference. So obviously, I'm doing something right.
Yay! But we know that you're doing something right. Now the world does.
Yeah, that's right.
So what? I'm all flustered here. Okay, so we are here doing our Doctor Who Redux. This is part 6, by the way. We may do a couple more, who knows. But today our focus is on showrunners and authors. So authors, you know, specific authors, specific writers, showrunners of the show. And I'm going to defer to Vicky on this to begin with. You know,
I just got here. No, it's okay. It's
but
okay.
You know so
the
much.
Rapture, yes, but the rapture has made me, I don't know, heavenly. I don't know. Okay.
You know, all of these excuses here, because I'm pretty sure that you two could both run a Doctor Who show with no research and probably in your sleep. So I don't want to hear your excuses. Let's get the fuck to it. Showrunners and writers.
Okay. Oh, you got it. Okay, what do you want me to... Okay, introduce me again. Sorry.
And say hello to Vicky Love, who just started her new show yesterday, and we'll talk about that after. But Vicky, please enlighten us on your thoughts of you know, just the basics of what a writer is, showrunner is, and particularly...
Well, how about something more entertaining than that? That's pretty dry. We all know what a writer is.
Could we delve into this really quickly, just like you know, pretend I'm stupid and talk to me in kindergarten words, but let's go ahead and, for the audience, wink, wink, define exactly what a showrunner is.
Okay, well, let's just remember that these so-called showrunners didn't really, they weren't invented until the 21st century, okay? Showrunner is just really another word for a writer who wants to be a producer. And so in traditional Hollywood, you have your writers over here and you have your producers over here. But in the middle of the 2000s, especially thanks to Russell T. Davies, who brought us the reboot of Doctor Who, because he was not only, he brought this back to us as a producer, he also wrote nearly half or more of the shows, the episodes. So this was like the creation. He wasn't the very first or by any means, but this is the creation of what we now call showrunner. And showrunners can either be really good like Davies was, or they can be really bad like someone like, oh, I don't know, Lindenhoff. I don't know.
Chibnall
was a pretty bad showrunner, yeah. Yeah, J.J. Abrams is a pretty bad showrunner.
Okay, so do showrunners actually put in their own money like a producer, or do they just get the title of producer?
It all depends. I know that if I have it right, Singer, I think it's Brian Singer in Hannibal. He was the showrunner for Hannibal, and he wants more Hannibal, but no matter what he does, and Hannibal is a highly rated show. No matter how.
Oh, I know. I was so pissed about that being canceled. But keep going.
Yeah, he is the showrunner. He is the writer, and he is the producer. He will throw in his own money, but he can't get it going. I don't know why. I think he pissed off some people that he shouldn't have. But you know, we all do that.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
So,
and part of it was, you know, the bullshit excuse they gave for it being canceled was like, really? Like, this is too woke for even cancel culture. But I was just wondering about that because, you know, you can associate these people with these shows, but like, say me, for example, I'm a producer for a couple of people, but that just means that I bought some shit from them and they put my name in the credits because I helped their fucking movies get made.
Right.
So I have to wonder about that every time I see somebody, especially somebody famous with producer credits. I'm like, but are you really a producer, or did you just go to Bro's house and buy a couple of his DVDs that he had spare? Because, you know, that's what I've done.
So, what
do I got to do to be a showrunner? Send him in some scripts, too?
I think to be a showrunner, you have to... You either have to have a lot of respect in the industry, or you got to bend over backwards or frontwards or whatever. You know, there's only two ways.
I am pretty flexible, but I don't like the idea of getting fucked by Hollywood. So I
guess we'll
keep that in the bedroom for now.
Yeah, it's a pretty sad. Hollywood's a pretty sad place right now. And all its branches or its tentacles or whatever, you know, the BBC, Amazon, Netflix, they're all in sad shape right now. They don't know what they're doing. They don't know. The only one I can say that really has any kind of a grip, and they don't really, is HBO. They're still producing good shows, but they got bought by Discovery that doesn't know what the fuck they're doing. So, you know.
Oh, my God, I know. I'm getting mad at HBO lately, so. The saddest thing is, like, exactly what we're talking about, Doctor Who.
Uh-huh.
There is not one place, not even the BBC, where I can find every Doctor Who. Like, I have to go to different places to get different seasons and stuff, and I think that's fucking ridiculous.
It is. That's why I have BritBox and HBO, but HBO is going to drop Doctor Who at some point because Russell T. Davies made a deal with Disney, and Doctor Who. So God only knows the future of Doctor Who reboot, whatever the BBC decides. I don't know. But right now you can get all the reboot, including the specials, the Christmas specials, on HBO Max. You can, because I watch them all the time. You know, if there's nothing else to watch, I know I can click on Doctor Who. So,
yeah,
and I'm happy.
True.
Yeah, but to get the classic Doctor Who, I had to buy BritBox, which I'm not, you know, complaining about. BritBox is a frickin' bargain. But after you've watched what you like on BritBox, then there's a lot of stuff that you don't like. And so, you know,
yeah,
like Netflix.
Because they have that tendency to go like 3 years between seasons of shows. I'm looking at you, Marcella. Like,
right.
Seriously.
Oh, yeah. Marcella's a good show, but, like,
how do I
wait
so long for a new season?
Shetland.
I don't even care anymore.
I know. I know. That's the business plan of Hollywood. In fact, on my show yesterday, we talked about this. The business plan of Hollywood has jumped into quarterly profits. And that's all you have to say is quarterly profits. If they don't get their quarterly profits to placate the shareholders, which there shouldn't even be shareholders in certain things like school districts and entertainment, anything that has to do with the arts should be free to create as much as they want, as long as they want, if the money, you know, keeps coming in, whatever. Anyway, it's so convoluted now. It's so twisted that a nuclear bomb is the only thing that's going to change things, I think.
Okay,
anyway,
I just want everyone to know, I just finished my first cigarette. We haven't even talked about any of the writers of Doctor Who. So I think maybe we should move on from this and talk a little bit.
Okay. Showrunners, the point I was trying to make is up until the 21st century, there was no real such thing as a showrunner. There, at the very beginning, where is her name? I love her name, Verity. I can't remember her last name. Let me see. I'm sorry I'm doing this. Verity Lambert. She was as close to the beginning Doctor Who showrunner as you can get. She produced it, and she worked on it. And she was faithful to it, so.
Now, what season did she work on? Because I remember seeing that name and thinking it was awesome.
Yeah, that name is awesome. I'm going to use it in my story. Actually, I'm writing a big story, and that name is in the story. So anyway, she was producer Unearthly Child. I'm going to get the date right here, the dates. She started Doctor Who, and the day after her death was the 44th anniversary of the show's debut, okay? She was producer to Mission to the Unknown, up to, from the Unearthly Child to Mission to the Unknown. And my internet sucks. So here we go. That was season 3. They don't want to tell me. Of course. It has Daleks in it. Oh, I think I just watched this. This is the second Doctor, I think. That's why. They want to show me a big advertisement for a fake Viking because I watch Vikings. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. See, the money. The money interferes with everything. It was
targeted ads strike again.
Yes. The Black Dalek leader, Terry Nation, wrote it. Verity produced it. And it was story number 19. So she was involved in 19 of the very first stories, from number 1 to number 19, which means there were all kinds of episodes within those 19. So that's several years. She is like, she would be the showrunner if she was today, if she was doing what she did for Doctor Who back then. That's a showrunner. They don't call them showrunners then because I don't know if they were trying to combine two jobs to save money like all business plans do by taking the head writer and making them the showrunner too, which makes them the producer also. Don't know. Haven't got an insight into that. So it wasn't until the reboot with Russell T. Davies that Doctor Who got a showrunner, quotation marks, big giant ones, okay? So that answers that question, I hope.
Thank you. It actually does.
Okay, so when you say showrunners, Carl, you really are referencing all of the new shows, because
exactly.
Doctor Who has only had three showrunners, and that's Russell. Well, actually, two. Well, three, but Russell T. Davies, Stephen Moffat, Chibnall, and then Russell T. Davies is coming back. So, in the past 20 years, there have been three.
So let's talk about the authors then and the writers, and we'll get to Chibnall and all those people a little later. You mentioned Terry Nation, and I just want to talk a little bit about Terry Nation. Terry worked on the early Doctor Who. He's the one who created Davros and the Daleks for Doctor Who. That's all Terry Nation. So anytime you see a Dalek or you see Davros, you know, tip of the hat to Terry Nation. I just want to also mention that he did a lot of, he started out writing for British comedy, but then he worked on Doctor Who. He also developed and Blake 7, which is one of my favorite British science fiction shows. He also, I've been
and,
watching. Okay. And
one of your other favorites.
Well, I was just about to say that because I've been watching The Avengers, and he wrote several of The Avengers, the early Avengers, particularly with Honor Blackman, and Survivors, too. So, I mean, he also worked with Brian Clemens, who I love, too. And, of course, Brian Clemens is The Avengers. So, you know, just want to mention, since you mentioned Terry Nation, you know, anytime you see the...
He also worked up until his death. He moved to Los Angeles, and up until he died of emphysema because he was a smoker. Sorry, guys. He produced many episodes of MacGyver with Richard Dean Anderson, not the new crap, the good, old, real MacGyver stuff. And so Terry Nation was just a creative powerhouse.
Absolutely.
And if you, where is my, let me see if I have it right here. I do not. If you buy the very first Doctor Who that's out on the market, it costs more than when I first purchased it. Where is it? I hid it from myself, of course, because I watch it too much. Doctor Who, The Beginning, and this is with William Hartnell, and it says years 1963 through 1966. If you purchase this DVD, it's three discs, and you watch the special features, they will tell you exactly how the Daleks came into existence. And it's really, 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 really creative, really fun. And if you love Doctor Who, you may just want to... I'm sorry. My technology just messed up. So anyway, that's Terry Nation is a creative powerhouse, and he absolutely is. It's worth it to buy that three-set DVD, the beginning with William Hartnell, just to have special features. Sorry, I got to deal with this.
That's okay. So I'm going to pass it over to Rachel. And Rachel, I know you want to talk about someone particularly. So
I do, and I might even have some news for you guys. I don't know how much you keep up with things, but my favorite author, just, you know, top three definite all-time favorite authors. I've met the guy. I've seen him do things and readings and just amazing. And that would be, of course, the infamous, the wonderful Neil Gaiman. And he's actually written three stories for Doctor Who. He wrote two really great episodes. That would be, the Nightmare in Silver. And Nightmare in Silver. And he's also written a short story ebook that was released for the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who. And it was called, let me look at that real quick.
Are you talking about, sorry, I wasn't listening. Are you talking about Neil Gaiman?
Yes.
Okay.
And he did, what was the other one? Oh, it's, Nightmare in Silver, The Doctor's Wife, and his new one, which is, here we go. Damn it. Nothing O'Clock. And it's got the Matt Smith 11th Doctor in it. Or that's what it's supposed to be about. Yeah.
Well, that's it. He did work mostly on the TV show with Matt Smith. So that makes sense. Totally makes sense.
Yes, I was really happy. And he's one of the few that wrote a really, really touching and scary God, why are their names escaping me all of a sudden? The robot men.
Oh, the Cybermen.
Cybermen.
Yes, Cybermen. Okay, there we go. He wrote a pretty intense Cybermen episode, so I just want to say that. That's a hard one to capture for me.
Is that the Nightmare in Silver?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And, of course, if you don't know who Neil Gaiman is, Coraline, so many great films. Stardust.
Oh my God,
yeah,
he's amazing.
American Gods. Look at his novels, graphic novels.
He's the writer of The Sandman. He also and he's producing on that show as well, because he needs to have his say in how that goes, because he is the only one that can make that work right. And I am glad that he was so involved with that production. Let's see. What was the other one? He was the co-writer of... holy shit, it's got David Tennant in it as well. Good Omens.
Oh, right.
I love Good Omens. I love Good Omens.
There was supposed to be a second season, but...
And there is a second season. It's coming out this year.
Yes.
Oh, really? Good.
Yes.
Yeah. It's been taking a long time to get second seasons of things, but I don't think they're going to get much going on American Gods anymore, because they've pissed everybody off by firing certain actors. So
right.
We're not going to go there, but yes, that is Neil Gaiman. You've probably seen and or loved something that he's written, and go back and read the books that all of his shit was based on, because his books are even better than his TV, I swear to God. But Absolutely. I loved that I knew he was going to be a writer of some of the episodes. And to be really honest with you, I tried to see if I could figure out without knowing which episodes were his, and I could not. So that was really impressive. And that is why he is probably my favorite, like, writer slash, I think he's actually listed as a showrunner for his couple of episodes. But, yeah, that's why he's my favorite on the series, because he's just my favorite in general, and he did such a smashing job that, yeah, he just gets to remain in my tops.
Yeah, you're so right about Neil Gaiman. I just think it's a treat that he's actually written a couple of Doctor Who's, and they were also very, very good. The Doctor's Why, completely different type of episode. It's a one-off, you know, you can watch it. It's a singular episode. It's in the middle of Rory and Amelia Khan. Amy, sorry. I like Amelia better. Just like the Doctor liked Amelia better, too. And the name. And so it's one of those episodes that you can just watch without really knowing too much about Doctor Who and then understand what's going on, even though it's about the TARDIS. It kind of gives you an idea of how crazy the TARDIS, the technology of the TARDIS really is. If you're a Doctor Who fan, you should watch the Doctor's Wife to find out exactly.
I consider that, and I know I'm not the only one that does, but I consider that to be one of the, you know, masterpieces of an episode. Like, every show that's really good has a few of those. And like I said, I'm not the only person that thinks, like, it's one of those episodes that, even if I didn't know, because at that point I didn't know that it was written by my favorite author, but of course it gave me all the feels, so I should have figured it out. Yeah, it's like you said, it's one of those standalone singular episodes that anybody can watch and, you know, understand what's going on without having to know everything else about what's going on, but it's also even more beautiful if you do know what's going on. So I love that dichotomy of the reality and the hopeful, you know, potential of things is what really makes the Doctor Who show so wonderful for me. And when people can't quite capture that is when I find that I start straying away from it.
Yeah. Pretty much the whole Chibnall run for me personally. I just can't. The stories just didn't gel. I don't know what was wrong with him, because some of my favorite episodes in the past. One, I really, really liked Dinosaurs on a Spaceship. A lot of people didn't like that, and a lot of people were asking for, when are we going to see dinosaurs in space or something like that? So Chibnall wrote that. I think he was commissioned to write it. I'm not sure. I'm not the Bible, the Doctor Who Bible. But since the reboot, you know how much people love dinosaurs. And so since the reboot, since the Ninth Doctor showed his face, people have been saying, how come we don't ever see the Doctor with dinosaurs? And because of that, we got the episode Dinosaurs on a Spaceship, and Chibnall wrote that. And judging from that, and The Power of Three, and The Hungry Earth, the double episode Hungry Earth and Cold Blood, you would have thought that Chibnall was the right choice, as I did, to carry on the showrunner title of Doctor Who. And I guess maybe that's all I can say about that.
He did write some good episodes, though. You gotta give him that.
Of reboot, but I don't think there's very many episodes within his his tenure as showrunner, a lot of those episodes were just, I mean, he brought back Captain Jack, and yet that was a terrible episode too. I think it was a two-parter, but anyway, it still didn't feel, it didn't gel. Captain Jack was there, but it didn't feel, it felt like he was put into it instead of innately part of it.
Right.
I guess that's
agreed.
What it is. So, anyway. Okay.
So, do you have a favorite author, Vicki, that you like? Either classic or reboot?
Outside of Davies, and a lot of things Moffat did too, I really liked. I know a lot of people have a problem with him, but I don't. But Mark Gatiss is one of my favorite writers, and I don't know why lately his stuff has been so bad. I don't know if it's just the trend in entertainment or what. So I'm just going to talk about what Mark Gatiss has done in the past, because I like most of his episodes, especially early on with the Ninth Doctor and Rose. The Unquiet Dead is one of my favorites. Cold War, The Crimson Horror, I really like that. Everyone hates Robot of Sherwood, but I don't know. I kind of like it.
It's nice.
And Sleep No More. I like Sleep No More also. And so Mark Gatiss is one of my favorite. I think he really, really, really did. He was at the height of his powers, writing powers, creative powers, when he was doing things like The Idiot Lantern, Victory of the Daleks, Night Terrors, because he was also writing Sherlock Holmes. And those were some of the best. And he was also acting in Sherlock Holmes. And these were some of the best written episodes of all of them, along with the Sherlock Holmes. So Mark Gatiss, definitely one of my favorites.
One other thing I want to talk about Mark Gatiss is he wrote probably the historical biography of one of the great horror directors. And considered the book on James Whale. Of course, James Whale, having directed Bride of Frankenstein and Frankenstein and various other films for Universal, and a wonderful book. So if you want to check that out also. Now, I'm going to mention somebody that I really like, and he only wrote one episode. But what I will tell you is what else he's written first. Okay, see if you can figure out who I'm talking about here. So basically, he started out writing for British comedy. Then he went into films, and his films include Four Weddings and a Funeral, Notting Hill, Bridget Jones' Diary, Love Actually, Bridget Jones, The Edge of Reason. My favorite film of his is a film called About Time, and he just did the film a couple years ago yesterday. He also wrote War Horse for Steven Spielberg.
He also
co-wrote for Blackadder, Mr. Bean, and The Vicar of Dibley. Have any idea who I'm talking about?
No.
Okay, that would be Richard Curtis. And Richard Curtis.
Oh, duh, Richard Curtis. Oh, okay. Slap me in the face.
Okay. Wrote one episode, and it's one of the best episodes of the reboot,
yes,
as far as I'm concerned.
Yes.
And that's,
yes,
Vincent,
yes,
and the Doctor, which I,
yes,
just love that episode. And again, this is an episode much like Damon, which changes the dynamic of what we expect from that show. And I love the heart of it. I love the fact that Vincent gets to see his own paintings. And I also love the fact that Bill Nighy, which is one of Curtis's best friends and a wonderful actor, also has a cameo in that particular episode. And I love that episode. I love Richard Curtis. And I just watch anything. I hate romantic comedies. And I can even stomach Bridget Jones. Okay? Yeah. And the other thing is the Vicar of Dibley is fucking hilarious. Seriously. So, yeah. Richard Curtis.
Okay, well, if we're going to talk about Vincent and the Doctor, we have to mention Tony Curran, who is one of my favorite actors, and he is the Vincent Van Gogh. He is. I don't know if he channeled him or what, but every time I watch, and most of my friends who love Doctor Who love this episode, say this is their favorite episode. He's just Vincent. He brings the heart, the soul, the painter's reality to this episode. It's just so good.
And I know he's very, very good as Vincent Van Gogh, but I do have to put a nod out to my other favorite Vincent Van Gogh, and that would be Tim Roth, who was in Altman's film and television miniseries Vincent and Theo. So there, just had to throw that in.
Think that Tony Curran's better, but that's my personal opinion, and so many others.
There you go. So do you know Vincent and the Doctor, Rachel? Do you know that particular episode?
Yeah, we've talked before. Like, I'm a huge fan of that episode. It's one of the major episodes that just made me fucking fall, man. And, you know, I'm not a particular huge Van Gogh fan, but I am an artist. I got respect for the bro. I just don't buy, like, his crappy prints like Sunflowers and fucking Starry Night and hang them up in my bathroom. I don't do that.
Wow.
I've got more respect for the guy than that.
I really understand going through
a blue period.
If you ever want to piss Tony Strauss off, just send him something from Vincent Van Gogh and he'll curse you out.
Yeah.
Never mind.
I'm not
Tony and I.
Yeah, no, I got it. But, I also have a little bit of an affinity for the character of Van Gogh versus the art of Van Gogh, because another one of my favorite writers, Christopher Moore, also wrote something that was very much about Van Gogh, and it's called Sacre Bleu. And it's about the particular, like, ultramarine-type blue that he used, and a couple of other particular artists also used. And, yeah, it's really interesting, and it's a comedy, but...
Okay.
Anyway, I love that episode.
So before we go on to the main three showrunners, are there any other authors you want to mention? Vicki?
Well, Joe Flanagan, who wrote most of the Sarah Jane Chronicle episodes. Oh, wait, whoops, it's not Joe Flanagan. Sorry, Philip Ford. I don't know why that was in red. Maybe he just passed away. Anyway, Phil Ford, he's a television writer and producer also, and he co-produced and was head writer for Sarah Jane, and he's had other accolades in television, like New Captain Scarlet, and he writes for Wizards vs. Aliens, just lots of stuff, and he wrote one episode of Torchwood. But what I really like both of the episodes that he wrote. One of them's a one-off for as an episode, and then The Waters of Mars is a David Tennant, it's a special David Tennant. It is not a regular episode of Doctor Who. It's an in-between series. Companions, but I think it's really at the end of the David Tennant era. But The Waters of Mars is really one of the best, best David Tennant episodes, if you want to call it. It's a special. It's a special, okay? And Russell T. Davies was involved in the writing of it. But the things that happen on Mars, and it's all about destiny, and what if you change your destiny? What if you hate what's happening to you right now? Like I just said something just, 15, 20 minutes ago about come take me away. But what if you change your destiny, and then your granddaughter or your grandson, you change their destiny? And so The Waters of Mars has a storyline that is so fantastic. Waters of Mars is scary. If you like zombies, it's scary. It's got all that in it. It's got perfect Doctor Who things in it. If you're afraid of drowning, don't watch it. But the thing is that it's more than just a scary episode. It has a philosophy to it. And so I would definitely say that that The Water of Mars, written by Phil Ford, is one of my favorite episodes. I've watched it many, many, many times. And that Phil Ford, he doesn't write the kind of TV that I usually watch. He did do Sarah Jane, and so, give it a try.
Now, he also did Coronation Street, which if you know anything about BBC, that's the premier soap opera for the BBC. It ran for years and years and years, and he was behind Coronation Street.
Well, there you go.
I want to also comment on one particular writer. And he only wrote one episode, and this is for the classic series. And if I say the episode, Vicki, let's see if you know who it is. The episode is The Pirate Planet.
The Pirate Planet?
Yes.
Oh, Douglas Adams, yeah.
Yep, absolutely. And of course, Douglas Adams is Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Right.
And The Pirate Planet is so much Douglas Adams. I mean, just the humor, everything. It's like, it's a little aside to the hitchhiker went to this part of the galaxy and he went to the pirate planet and this is what happened. And that's exactly the way it feels when you see that specific. Of course, Adams also wrote Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency, The Deeper Meaning of Lif, and he also did patient abuse for the final episode of Monty Python's Flying Circus. So this is a guy that, once in a while you'll find a lighter sort of Doctor Who episode. And the same can be said with the Richard Curtis episode, too. But I kind of like that as sort of like a palate cleanser to a lot of the things that encounter that are scary in Doctor Who. So definitely wanted to mention Douglas Adams.
Yeah, I'm glad you did.
Okay,
oh
good.
No, it's a good episode. It's it stands on its own. It's memorable. But this is the one thing that I'd like to emphasize on this show about Doctor Who. In my old job, being the pillar of society and teaching children how to read and write, blah, 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 I was looked down upon because I was a fan of science fiction, a fan of Doctor Who, a fan of all the things I actually love. I was put over here in this category of you can't teach AP because you know too much about science fiction. Let me just say this. Doctor Who is not that, although it's been associated as an adolescent entertainment. Look at the people who actually write the episodes. Look at the episodes themselves. Look at the subject matter that they deal with. And you will see that this isn't the stuff of a child's nightmare or a child's fantasy. They deal with real things, real emotions, and real things that happen in life. And so you have really good writers. And mm-hmm. even if they're the old shows in the black and white, I'm amazed sometimes by the writing. I'm just like, wow, if only they wrote like this today. The words that the actors speak, the ideas that are brought forth in these stories, it's not for kids. It's not kiddie.
No.
Kids will enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, go ahead. I'm not.
No, that's okay. I think that's also, you know, when we talk about writing, it's not just about the plot. It's about the characters and how they're developed and the interrelationships. And we talked previously about, you know, who our favorite companions are and why and what and how that all worked out. And each writer has his own thoughts on that. And then, of course, if the relationship between the companion and the doctor is already set, then they can expand it. And I think, you know, a lot of that is sort of glossed over, you know.
Right.
And of course, if we talk about the, you know, the reboot series, I think now is the time to really talk about Russell Davies and what he really did for Doctor Who and how the reboot really worked well under his tutelage for the number of years that he was with Doctor Who. Because let's face it, from that first episode, from Rose on, we were hooked. Seriously.
You know, when you're talking about writers, Jones is a very well-known writer and also was a writer for Coronation Street, like you
right.
mentioned earlier. He also helped produce and pen Queer as Folk that lots of people used to. I even used to watch it when it first came out a long time ago. He wrote two of my favorite Doctor Who episodes, and that was under Davies. That's The Impossible Planet and The Satan Pit. And this is when Rose is beginning to really trust the Doctor and understand that it's the same Doctor as, you know, he had regenerated, and she still was a little untrustworthy. And so these two episodes together, plus it had this creature in it that looked exactly like our Nightmares of Satan, and it all just worked really well. And you couldn't have got that without Russell T. Davies inviting someone like Matt Jones to come in and collaborate and write these two episodes.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. And that's what a showrunner does. He gets the right group of writers together that'll work within the context of where he wants to go. And that's exactly what Russell T. Davies did.
Right.
I mean, you take a look all the way through and just an amazing amount of episodes. You know, let's not forget, you know my situation with the runaway bride, and of course that's Donna Noble. It's his decision, and he wrote that episode to bring in Donna Noble and change the tone a bit. And
right.
and as you know, that's his decision, and he set it up. And the man, I think, really has a great knack of knowing where he wants to go with the series and knowing how to get you there and to make you interested and to keep you interested in seeing how it develops. Now, I know I want to bring this back to Rachel. Rachel, you know, you began watching Doctor Who when it first came in as a reboot. And you've said this a couple of times as how that first episode, really attracted you to the shows, to Doctor Who. So talk a little bit about that. Why do you think it was that you know, you connected with it so well?
Honestly, I don't really know what it was, because at first I was like, I don't know how I feel about this. But then you get like the weird mannequins and Rose being kind of a badass, and you've got this, you know, I always expected the Doctor, because I'd seen snippets of episodes from the previous stuff before, just like on reruns, but I never sat down and watched an episode of it. So, you know, you're kind of expecting the Doctor to be this stuffy older dude with some weird accoutrement, and it's this decent looking asshole in a leather jacket. And so I was kind of interested to see where that went. Like, how is this related to all of this other stuff that I've seen and heard about Doctor Who in my life? But I did go into Doctor Who completely unawares of what was, like, really going on. I didn't know anything about the story. And so, yeah, I was interested to see where it went, honestly.
So to elaborate my point a little bit, and I'll take this over to Vic. You saw this decent-looking guy in a leather suit, and like, okay, where is this going? How does that work, Vicki, do you think, that you're reintroduced to Doctor Who, and it's Christopher Eccleston, it's a different look and that sort of thing. Is that the reason that most of the people were interested to see where this was going, was just that particular sense of it? Or was there something else, or was it, the introduction of Rose? What do you think it was?
I think it's just good writing with good actors. That's the truth of the matter is that if there's good writing, even let's just take this for an example. That movie that totally depressed me this past season, that's going to win all the awards, the Banshees of Inisherin, however you say that word.
Inisherin.
Yeah, you can't pronounce it. He wrote it that way. I already read it. I hate that fucker. Anyway, here's a movie and a book. I would never read the book. But it is done with really fine actors, and it is written really well. And the story is not something that I ever want to subject my subconscious to ever again, but it's done in such a fantastic way that you're going to sit down and watch it, and you're going to think about it. And I think that's the whole key to what Russell T. Davies did. He knows what's good. He knows how to write. He knows how to bring writers in. He knows how to, in his interviews, he knows how to find the right person for the Doctor, the right person for the companion, and then write to that. And that's what it is. It's not so much that Eccleston was wearing a nice, beautiful leather jacket that I was really jealous of. It wasn't
right.
that Rose had that beautiful, gorgeous blonde hair that I was jealous of. They had chemistry, and Davies knew it. And so he
well,
wrote good words. Yeah, go ahead.
That's what I'm that was I was going to say earlier, you know, Carl took kind of the wrong point from that. No, it wasn't just the guy wearing an awesome leather jacket that I was super jealous of, which, by the way, Rose had some pretty awesome jackets in that show
yes,
as well.
Yes, she did. She had some great
so
clothes.
So fucking jealous.
Boy. Yes.
Oh, let me tell you. It wasn't just that. I wasn't just attracted to the look of it because, actually, I mean, frankly, it was BBC, so it was filmed kind of shitty for what I'm used to. But it wasn't just that. I wanted to see, like, from what I knew about Doctor Who, you know, these funny, weird doctors with their top hats, their, you know, their fez and their long scarves and their whatnots, like, how does this fit into all of that? Like, what is going on here? And also, those plastic people are fucking scary. And so, yeah, like, there was good writing is what attracted me, but it was also they wrote these characters to be kind of vastly different than what I think people were used to from the previous seasons of The Doctors. And I'm just gathering this from my knowledge of the previous seasons of The Doctors that I learned about from the current seasons of The Doctor. So, because they have done, if you've watched all the other shows, which admittedly I have shamelessly watched all of the other shows, we've talked about that, Torchwood and Sarah Jane, all of that, and they
yeah.
all do a really good job of flashing back and even using actual footage from the original Doctor Who series. So I've always thought that that was a really good continuity thing that they that they've grasped pretty specifically in this show.
That is, you're right. We have never even talked about that. But the continuity between the classic and the reboot is there. It's solid. And I love continuity. When we're on set and we're filming, like, scenes for the film, for our movie, and somebody's hair is out of place, I stop everything and go, ooh, continuity time, and try to get their clothing exactly right, their hair right, all that stuff, because continuity to me is the thing that breaks the magic. If it's not right.
I almost, yeah.
Yeah?
I almost stopped watching a movie yesterday because mm-hmm. she was sitting in the car, and they panned over to her sitting in the car, and the window was down. She opens the door, gets out, closes the door, and the window's up.
Oh, see? That's an honest mistake, I'm sure. They probably were on a street. They probably didn't have a lot of time, and they had to go with it. But, yeah, continuity will break you.
Well,
yeah.
Definitely. And I just, like, it was actually a show, I think. Yeah, it was a show. And for the rest of the episode, all I could do was sit there and, like, just, oh, my God, what else are they going to do wrong? What else are they going to do wrong? And then I was just looking for stuff the rest of the time, and I found too much. And I was like, okay, I can't do this anymore. I'm done.
That's terrible. And then they didn't have anyone looking for the continuity. That's the one thing I think that was the brilliance of Russell T. Davies. And then I think that Moffat also has that, not to the extent of Davies, but definitely brought it into his tenure. But
mm-hmm.
Davies was the brilliance of that. He has all these different qualities.
The thing about Stephen Moffat, which we're going to talk about now, is he was brought in to Doctor Who by Russell T. Davies and worked
right.
specifically with Davies. And of course, The Empty Child, The Doctor Dances is like one of the greatest fucking two-sided episodes there have ever been in Doctor Who. That's the Empty Child and The Doctor Dances.
Oh,
the
and
the one
Doctor
with the
Dances,
death
yeah.
mask.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
You know,
you don't even have to. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
If I've watched those once,
and of course,
I've watched
let's
them
not forget,
a million times.
Oh, yeah. Let's not forget that Stephen Moffat also gave us the Weeping Angels.
Yes, he invented the Weeping Angels and the greatest Doctor Who character outside of the Doctor, River Song.
Absolutely.
He's the one who invented, yes, River Song. So if you love River Song, then you need to love Stephen Moffat. And so many people would say, oh, Stephen Moffat, he doesn't even know what Doctor Who is all about. Really? Because if you look, Stephen Moffat wrote more Doctor Who than anyone, any other single person.
Yeah.
Stephen Moffat's written more episodes than any other single person in the whole classic to reboot Doctor Who.
Okay. Let's not forget also that one of the reasons he was brought in was that he actually wrote short fiction on Doctor Who. And he contributed a segment to Paul Cornell's Virgin New Adventures novel, and so he started off with the novels. And just a great writer. I mean, the stuff that he did, Coupling before that, and he did Sherlock. He did the Dracula TV series.
I just finished watching something else that he just did. I guess I ought to find out what that
is.
Yeah,
and I know, and it was not good.
And it wasn't
What? It was Inside Man. Remember we talked about that, and I?
Oh, we talked about it, yes, because it was so unbelievable. Plus, no, this is the one, The Time Traveler's Wife. It was so bad, HBO ripped it out of viewing and has never, ever put it back in for viewing. People hated it that much. And so Stephen Moffat is brilliant when it comes to Doctor Who, but I didn't think Dracula was very good either. And Gaddis also wrote, because I don't like vampires, I don't like zombies, not a fan of horror in the general sense. And so I turned on Dracula because it's Moffat and Gaddis. And their humor felt kind of dull, I thought. And their actors didn't have chemistry. I don't know what happened. But in Doctor Who, it was magic. In Dracula, it wasn't. And then it just went down from there. Inside Man was, the whole premise was what did you call it?
Stupid.
Is it? Yeah.
Stupid.
Unbelievable, yeah. Yeah, the woman in the basement was the most unbelievable of all. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
But
when it comes to Doctor Who, and I think part of that is he was working with Davies. I really think that Davies had such a major, major impact, and I also think that Davies coming back to Doctor Who is going to be hopefully a really good thing. And you know, after the Jodie Whittaker series, and I don't, again, we've talked about this, we don't really fault Jodie Whittaker as much as we do the other person we should talk about, Chris Chibnall.
I don't know. I've watched every single episode. In fact, I bought every single episode. I have them on my streaming. I won't buy the DVDs. In my DVD collection, I have as much as I possibly can of Doctor Who. I have all the reboot episodes except Chibnall's stuff. I get bored with it. The writing is so bad, I get bored with it. Not that I didn't love a couple of the companions. I really liked some of the companions. Other than that, the writing was just not up to Doctor Who standards.
No.
Personally, that's what I thought.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. And Rachel, you hadn't really watched any of the Jodie Whittaker either, have you?
No, I really haven't.
Yeah, because
I haven't seen a single one of them yet. I think I can now because, like I said, I only watch Doctor Who when it's available to me for free. I'm not going to pay for a subscription so I could see it. But
right.
I think I can watch those now, and I've really been debating about whether I want to or not.
If you have HBO, I'm certain you can see those episodes. But if you don't
have
HBO...
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, is I do.
Yeah.
I have, like, all the streaming services at this point. I've actually got to downsize and figure out which ones are useful to me at this point.
Yeah,
because I do. I've got passwords for just about everything, and, you know, we have just about everything else because, you know, well, Carl can attest to that. He's got all my passwords. Oh,
well,
you didn't hear that, streaming services.
Oh, right now I'm so angry with streaming services. They, just what I learned about Netflix over the past 3 days has
you're going to have to talk to me about this. I don't know what's up.
Well, I think it's worth it to just mention it on a Doctor Who episode or podcast because we're trying to watch our favorite shows. Netflix has a business model now that I've noticed it over the past. You know how the rating, it goes, they use certain words. This is streaming now. And then there's also the rating with the thumbs up and thumbs down and the double thumbs up. It's not just whether you like it or you don't. God, you must love it. Okay, Netflix judges whether or not they will bring you another season of whatever you're watching as soon as they put it out. Like, say, this week, Vikings Valhalla came out, and we binged it because it was only like 6 or 8 episodes, and they're only 40 minutes each. And we binged it, but I don't always binge. I've never watched Wednesday yet. Okay, I'm one of the only people in America, I guess. But the thing is, I don't always have time to watch whatever it is in front of us. And so, if you don't watch it that first week or 2 weeks of it, and they don't have 1 million-plus viewers, they don't care how many thumbs up it gets later on. They're going to cancel it. That's Netflix's new business model. That means that the streaming service that said, hey, you can watch shows anytime you want, it's your convenience, is not, that's not what they are anymore. It's not your convenience. It's you come watch our shows so that we can invest in them again.
Yeah, I'm not liking that. And now that you say something like that, I can see it because I'm getting a lot less, you know, continuation on things than I would really appreciate. And I'm starting to get kind of mad because I have been a customer of Netflix since back in the DVD dark ages.
Right.
And, I mean, there's been a couple of times my membership has lapsed slightly, but you've got to think. I've been a customer of theirs since the fucking beginning. And
so you helped build their empire.
Yeah, and I don't feel respected as a customer when they continue to just raise their prices and raise their prices and lose the rights to all of their content that people really care about. Like, I haven't seen a person yet that isn't pissed that they canceled BOA.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But they continued Lucifer. And frankly, you know, Lucifer in the beginning, I'm not going to lie, like, I got my little girly boner on for that for a little bit. But it got to a point where they could have just used that money for something else that the people really genuinely wanted. Like, we were all getting bored with the Angels and Devils Among Us story. I'm sorry. And there's only so many times that beautiful man can sing without his shirt on before it just becomes blasé again.
It's
so
pandering.
Yeah. Yes, it's just pandering. And, like, when you start singing Bo Burnham songs in your head, because that's exactly what it is, it's pandering.
Right.
You just can't do it anymore. And I feel almost like that's what they were trying to do with Jodie Whittaker in Doctor Who.
Yes, that was just going through my mind.
Not that I don't love a semi-androgynous, you know, female doctor. Everybody wanted to see a female doctor, but I don't think they did it the right way from everything that I've heard. Even my very feminist male friends, they're like, dude, Rachel, I just don't know how I feel about this.
Right.
And so, I mean, that's actually got me debating on whether I really want to watch this season or not.
Exactly.
Because, frankly, I just... I don't want to disappoint myself. I have so much love for the Doctor right now that I don't know if I can handle the disappointment. Like, maybe here in like 6 months or a year I can try, but I've got too much going on in my life right now, and I need my Doctor to be reliable currently.
Exactly. I think that Hollywood has lost that exact motivation. We want our entertainment. We're paying for entertainment, not so they can boost their egos, but so that when we come home from work or whatever the hell the family's getting into today, or the gas prices are too high and I have to decide gas or food, we want to come home and have our entertainment that is going to relieve that stress for an hour or two so we can at least sleep at night. And that is not what we're getting from our entertainment. And it starts with the Doctor Who reboot of Chibnall and a female doctor done in the totally wrong way. They forget. We're the customers here, not your ego. So,
frankly,
yeah.
That's exactly it is, you know, you and I are two of the biggest feminists I know, and I feel no shame in saying I'm not comfortable with their iteration of a female doctor. Just from the random things that I know about it, I don't think it's going to work. It doesn't work for me. I'm sorry.
If I could put my 2 cents work in this, I have been rewatching the original Avengers, and all I can think of, if you want a doctor, you know, Diana Rigg in her prime would have been a great doctor, I think. I think the reason, you know, I think Chibnall's writing of Jodie Whittaker's character was too not wishy-washy, but too pun related. You know, the humor just didn't work.
Right.
And she, to me, as the character was written, was not strong enough. And so I've always been, you know, attracted to stronger female characters, Pam Grier, you know, Diana Rigg, and something like that would have worked for me better. Now, that's just my personal opinion. We all have different, you know, ways of looking at it and what expectations. But nonetheless, I don't think that hardly anyone's expectations were met by the writing of the Doctor in the Jodie Whittaker era. I think that's the failing of it.
Chibnall was trying, he listened to public opinion too much. And this is what it looks like. I don't know. Maybe he didn't listen at all. Maybe it was just in his mind to say, well, this week I'm going to write her and she's going to act like the fifth Doctor. And this week I'm going to write her and she's going to act like the ninth Doctor. And this week I'm going to write her and she's going to act like the second Doctor. Because
I think that's a really good point, because I saw that too. There wasn't
I
any,
noticed it.
You know.
There, yeah,
but she never really got her footing
using the word continuity. There was no continuity in the character.
In the character.
Okay.
See,
enough,
I could not handle that.
It, yeah.
No.
It,
no.
You think she's going to act in this way, and so you watched last week's episode, and then you come to this week's episode, and I'm thinking about when I watched it when they were coming out week after week. And you come into this week's episode, and she acts completely different, and then in the middle of the show, you're like, wait a second, isn't she, like, channeling the second Doctor right now? But last week, she was the ninth Doctor? Wait a second. And it was disturbing. It was disturbing to see the Doctor kind of schizophrenic.
Yeah, agreed.
I can see that.
All right, folks. I'm going to go around the table one last time. Are there any other authors or people that we want to mention before we get into housekeeping? We'll start with Vic.
Well, I think I mentioned the ones, the episodes I liked, and I also very much said that all the writers, there's hardly any episode that I love to put on the classic Doctor Who while I'm cooking dinner, chopping and making these elaborate meals that I make. So I spend like an hour or so in the kitchen many times a week. And my TV's right there across the room. And sometimes I'm not even watching the visuals. I'm just listening. And I just am amazed by the words coming out of these people's mouths. They are so good. The writing is so good. So, yeah, that's give Doctor Who a try if you're looking for good writing. And the visuals will, you know, cut them a break. You know, classic Doctor Who had zero budget. They had to use what they had to use. And it's fun to see them using those things. But the writing is always solid. Always. Up until Chibnall. The writing is solid. That's what I want to say.
And I would agree 100% on that. There's just so many good writers and that. And depending on the era, I think one of the things that most of the writers did was to be consistent with who the Doctor was and what their personality was at the time. And good, you know, there isn't anyone I want to specifically mention, but, you know, the early Doctor Who, as far as the writing's concerned, is as good, you know, as the later. You know, I mean, there are certain times where it will dip in quality and such, but we're talking about a show that's almost 60 years old now.
Right.
And it is amazing how consistent they've been throughout those 60 years. And you got to applaud the writers. And I think the writers are the most underrated and undervalued of anyone in film or TV, period. So that's what I got to say. You got anything else to say, Rach, before we get on to housekeeping?
No, I think you guys pretty well covered that one there.
All right. So one of the things that I do have to mention is that Vicky basically did a lot of backtracking into an episode we did yesterday. And I do want to talk about your new show, Vicky, The Enchanted Kaleidoscope. We had our premiere episode yesterday. And why don't you just give them an idea of what you're going to do 2 weeks from a week from this coming Monday you're going to be back. But just tell them a little bit about the show.
Okay. I used to be the host for Vicky Loves Sci-Fi on Stephen Ronquillo's network. And my shows were all about science fiction, all of them, mostly all of them. Of course, I guested on Carl's show and Stephen's shows, other shows about other subjects, but I was really in the lane of science fiction. And although, you know, I love science fiction and I couldn't live my life without science fiction, as you can tell from the Doctor Who episodes that we've been doing, I wanted to branch. I wanted to stretch out because I actually really love fantasy also. If you came into my house and you looked at my shelves, I have a library. I built a library. Yes, I'm old-fashioned, but I love books, and I love DVD. I love, you know, text, you know, the feel of things. So anyway, half of my books are science fiction. Half of them are fantasy, but also half of them are also science books. So my show is all about science fiction, fantasy, and how real science mixes into both of these genres. And that's what I'm trying to do with this show, bring in all of this stuff together to show people not just continuity in our lives, but show people how all this stuff runs together and can enrich your life. Enrich your life. You don't just have to sit down and watch the same old thing all the time. There are reasons why science and science fiction go hand in hand. But there's also lots of science in fantasy. And it, like when a wizard puts together a bunch of herbs and cures somebody, you know, if the writer was a good writer, they're going to put together a bunch of herbs that are actually something that, so that's what I want to do. Got it? That's what it's about. So I haven't really chosen my subject for next week, but I think it's going to be more into fantasy and films.
Okay.
Okay.
So that's what to look forward to on the Enchanted Kaleidoscope. Also, I want to talk about tomorrow's show. We have Whit Strub and Peter Alalunas and Pat Crane and another gentleman. And I'm going to be basically just the host of a roundtable about the director, Roberta Findlay. Roberta Findlay is one of the premier sexploitation directors and grindhouse directors, and also one of the few female voices in that particular genre. And so we're going to be doing that, and that will be tomorrow at 8 o'clock Eastern Time. And then on Sunday, TC will be doing his Rock This Down Radio. He wanted to do it this past Sunday before Martin Luther King Day, but schedule got a little bit bamboozled. So he'll be doing this on Sunday, and it's all songs from the year 1968, and of course that was the year that both Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King were assassinated. So he's going to be doing that on Sunday. We have a number of things coming in the next weeks. Doc will be back with Voices for the Bog on the 25th. Cathar Gray Mission will be back on the 27th. We're going to have a lot of other shows in between, as far as we're still going to be doing our winter commentary watches. Also, in the future, we're going to be doing a very, very special commentary watch for Rachel. We're not going to say what it is yet, but in celebration of something that's happening for Rachel. So there you go.
Yeah, sorry, guys. I've been a little busy and a little out of the loop lately, going through a whole lot of really awesome life changes, hopefully beginning tomorrow. So we'll announce that on our next shows, what that is, and when we can do our commentary special. Yay!
Yes, and that is something to truly celebrate. I just want everyone to know that. And that's what's coming up, and we've got lots of other things in brewing in the cauldron, down in the cellar, actually in the cave, you know, Carl's Cavern. And we'll be discussing those things as they bubble up and get set. So right now, I want to, again, thank both of you for coming on. Vicki, it's wonderful to have you on the network. And you're back where you belong, and I think it's actually fantastic. Rachel, as always, you're my right hand. You're my right hand and someone I couldn't do this with without you. So for both Rachel and Vicki and myself, we want to thank everyone for listening. And I think at this point we say good night, good afternoon, good morning, whatever it is for you guys. So let's do that
good
now,
night.
Folks. Good morning.
Bye, everybody.
Have
bye.
A great day, everyone.
Absolutely. Okay, thanks a lot. Good night, everyone.